The whole of the view from our bungalow is quite astonishingly lovely.
I think it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Those trees and flowers and the wonderful colors that are so vivid. I don't think anywhere else in the world have I seen any colors quite so vivid as they are.
So that it really makes it all the worse when you think of conditions as they are today.
Yes, because as one gets up in the morning and goes outside, the first thing one sees is the guards changing and marching past the barbed wire, and one has to make sure that the gates are all shut so that the children can't run outside. And it spoils the whole of the atmosphere of the country at the moment.
The garden with its brilliant tropical flowers and shrubs and a tall tulip tree blazing with flame-coloured blossom was exquisite. Mrs. Lucy is a great gardener and she's very proud of her standard hibiscus. And the view beyond, as she said, was astonishingly lovely. You looked out over the plantations of rubber trees with their pale grey mottled trunks to a jungly mountainous valley. So I was sitting out there on the lawn drinking tea and eating mangosteens. I could hardly believe that a few minutes before, the friend who had driven me out from Kuala Lumpur had rushed off in a hurry. He wanted to make sure of being home before darkness fell and the road back became a possible death trap from bandit attack. Our conversation out there on the lawn was constantly interrupted by the Lucy's 3-year-old twin boys, lovely, fair-haired, friendly little fellows, who kept coming up to show me their toys. I asked Mrs. Lucy how she managed with the twins, cut off from the outside world as she is virtually by the high barbed wire fence that runs round the garden.
The twins play about in their nursery in the first part of the morning. Their nursery is like an ordinary nursery in most ways, but it is surrounded by a 2-foot-wide barricade of sand, so that no possible stray bullets can come into it. It's difficult to imagine that the twins never go for a walk. They never go anywhere outside the barbed wire unless they go in our armored car. And since about a year ago, a small girl on a estate near us was murdered by the bandits, and she was the same age as the twins. And since then, I've never left them at any time alone on the estate without a European in charge.
Some months ago, the Lucys went through a very bad period when they were attacked by the bandits almost every night for over a month. You see, what you've got to understand about this Malayan war is that it's not only troops who are in the fight, but everyone who lives in the country, European and Asian, young and old, men, women and children. I asked Mrs. Lucy if she could describe what it was like when a night attack started up.
Yes, I can very well, because we have been attacked. The children live in, their room is an annex off the house, and when the bullets start coming overhead or are aimed actually at the bungalow, my first job is to go and get the children and bring them into our bungalow, which is concrete. And then after that, I telephone up the police and the military, providing that the telephone line hasn't been cut. Very often they do cut the telephone line, so in that case we really are entirely on our own and have to rely upon our own resources. Then, if our police lieutenant is not with us, I get out the Bren gun and cock it, and get ready for action.
You're useful with a Bren gun, are you?
Yes. Yes, I've had quite a lot of practice with it, and because very often I'm left on my own when my husband has to go on long tours, and which he does fairly frequently, about twice a week, to various parts of the country. And I do feel that a planter's wife at the moment should be able to handle every weapon that is in the house.
Absolutely, particularly when you've got children to think of.
Yes, because so far these terrible communists have not shown any mercy to anybody. And I don't feel that either the children or I are safe from their attack.
And your one object is to get one, isn't it?
Yes, I was quite envious of my husband when he shot one the other day. I've always felt that I could in some way repay the death of my various friends by getting one or two in return.
Yes, of course, they really don't deserve much mercy.
They don't deserve any mercy. They have committed such terrible atrocities that they are just like wild beasts.
The fight with these wild beasts, the emergency in Malaya, has been going on, as I say now, for over 3.5 years. The fight which involves soldiers and police and home guards and rubber planters and tin miners and farmers. In fact, the fight in which everyone in Malaya is concerned in one way or another. That son of yours in the army, maybe, or that cousin who manages a rubber estate. The origins of the emergency go back a long way. There's been a Malayan Communist Party ever since the early 1920s, a predominantly Chinese organization. During the war, it cooperated with the Southeast Asia Command in the fight with the Japanese. But afterwards, after the Japanese surrender, the party started collecting arms and stores and building up a network of jungle camps all over Malaya. Terrorism then started to get worse and worse in the beginning of 1948, and with it widespread labor trouble engineered by the communists. And then finally, when 3 rubber planters were murdered, a state of emergency was proclaimed, first in 2 states, and then over the whole Federation of Malaya. And the struggle has been going on ever since. It's a struggle that keeps fully occupied about 30,000 troops and over 100,000 regular and auxiliary police. And what about the bandits? Well, they're reckoned to number between 3,500 and 5,000 young fighting communists. Supporting them is a much larger number, maybe 100,000 unarmed communist sympathizers called the Minyuan, whose job it is to keep the bandits supplied with food, clothing, and money. It seems somehow fantastic that such a small force of communist bandits can hold out against all these troops and police. But it's Lieutenant General Sir Charles Keatley, Commander-in-Chief Far East Land Forces, who really brings it home to you that they have a tremendous force fighting for them, all the millions of trees of the jungle.
Malaya is 80% thick jungle, and as such, the trouble is to bring the bandits to battle. If we find them as a result of a patrol or as a result of an ambush, then they have their lines of withdrawal through the jungle carefully worked out and reconnoitred, and it's very easy indeed for them to get away. To surround a body of bandits in the jungle is almost impossible because you can pass within a yard of somebody and never realize that they're there. But probably the chief problem we have in the whole of this fighting of the bandit war is that of information. We are fighting this war to a certain extent with our hands tied behind our back, because the only times that we get at the bandits are as a result either of an ambush or an incident laid on by the bandits, or as a result of an army patrol who finds a bandit camp. In either of those cases, naturally, we fight the war at the worst possible state for ourselves, because the bandit is in the first place prepared and we fight him on his ground, and in the second case, we haven't got behind him, and he's able to get away into the jungle. What we require more than anything is information.
Getting hold of information is the job of the Emergency Information Service. They get it from captured bandits and surrendered bandits, and sometimes from captured documents. I spent a fascinating morning going through some of these with Mr. A.W.D. James, head of the Emergency Information Service. One thing that was very clear is that the bandits were uncommonly well organized and also very self-critical. There were several documents in which, in true communist fashion, they denounced themselves for lack of zeal or for carelessness. And among these documents, Mr. James read an extortion letter which shows how the bandits collect funds.
Comrade Sukulingnam, do not be misled when you hear that many Taukes or shopkeepers have been robbed of their property and even some of them were killed by us. This does not mean that we want their property, but it was due to their uncooperativeness and siding with the British imperialists. So we take them to be our enemies. Now let us together drive away the British imperialists from Malaya. We hope to get a sum of $1,000 from you as a start. We think this will not be a great improvement. We also hope to get a sum of $200 every month from you. We have informed you about this previously, and we hope that you will consider it carefully. Otherwise, we do not guarantee your safety and the safety of your property.
Yes, they're ruthless people, these Chinese communist guerrillas. While I was in Kuala Lumpur, I met some of the men of the Suffolk Regiment who've been out in Malaya for some 2.5 years now, mostly spent in patrol operations or engaged in ambushes. I asked Lieutenant Godfrey about ambushes in the jungle, both our own and the enemy's.
When we are ambushers, as opposed to being ambushed, it usually develops into being rather a boring affair, as I suppose in every, say, 15 to 20 ambushes that we do, we are lucky if we're successful in getting any result out of one. And of course, as a result, one does tend to become rather depressed at the thought of going out and sitting, being bitten by mosquitoes and sandflies, and having leeches crawling over one, when you realize that, in fact, the chance is very slim that you will be able to achieve anything.
What about the other kind of ambush?
Well, we've been very fortunate so far in the Suffolks and have suffered very few casualties from ambushes by the enemy. I think the worst one I can recall is an 8 platoon was ambushed in the Kajang area about 6 months ago. And we suffered four casualties, one of whom died. And however, we were able to achieve remarkable success of killing 5 bandits. And for that action, a corporal was awarded DCM.
Sergeant Fowler, also of the Suffolks, told me of another action in which they cooperated with the Royal West Kent Regiment. He told how in Selangor, a party of bandits attacked the officer commanding the police of the district. They killed him and a Malay police lance corporal and wounded 3 others. The Suffolks and the Royal West Kents were called in to deal with the situation.
I was coming down an estate track in a rubber plantation near the jungle edge. I saw a party of chaps in jungle green wearing jungle hats, exactly the same uniform as we wear, and not naturally thought that they were the Royal West Kent party who had swept through. So in order that we didn't shoot them up and they didn't shoot us, I waved my hand at them and yelled, "Hello there, West Kents. Hello there, West Kents." Oh, of course, when they ducked and ran for it, they decided they were not West Kents at all, but bandits. So we chased off like the hammers of Hades after them, and we finally caught up with them. We came over a hill, and running down the hill towards a stream, my section in line with me, in line abreast, and the bandits opened up from the other hill on the other side of the stream. They were firing an LMG, a Bren gun, that is, a Sten, Tommy, carbine, and rifles. As we later found out, there were 16 of them, and there were 9 of us. However, we got away with no casualties at all, and managed to kill 3 of them, one of whom was the platoon commander.
That's what struck me as so extraordinary about this jungle fighting. The killing of 3 bandits is regarded as a notable success, the voluntary surrender of a single man as a kind of minor triumph. Everything seems to be on such a ridiculously small scale. In the action just described by Sergeant Fowler, the second-in-command of the bandit unit surrendered to the police the next day. I met an ex-bandit while I was in Malaya who may very well have been this one. I was down at the Kuang resettlement area, about 20 miles from Kuala Lumpur, in the center of a fairly bad bandit area. I drove down there with Hugh Howes of the Psychological Warfare Department. About halfway, we picked up an armed escort, and all along the main road and along the side road we turned down to get to Kuang, we scattered propaganda pamphlets from the cars we went along. They were written in Chinese, and they had pictures of ex-bandits living comfortably, smoking cigarettes and enjoying themselves. The wind carried the blue and pink sheets into the rubber plantations and the jungle on the sides of the road. Passers-by picked them up. Sooner or later, a few might find their way into a bandit's pack. Sooner or later, maybe another bandit would be tempted to give up the hard life of the jungle and surrender. The Kuang resettlement area was a collection of wooden houses thatched with attap, a kind of palm leaf, and teeming with Chinese, and particularly Chinese children, who gathered round the loudspeaker van which had come with us in our little convoy. The loudspeakers blared music to gather the crowd. And then a voice followed, speaking in the Hakka dialect of Chinese. This is one of the ex-bandits talking.
Yes, he was the second in command of 9th Platoon, which is one of the formations of the Communist Bandit Army, which is operating in this area. He surrendered about 4 months ago. His name is Lai Kim San. He's speaking to people in Hakka and telling them of his past life in the jungle, the areas which he used to operate, and of how he was told before he went into the jungle that life in the jungle was pleasant. They had plenty of food, good accommodation, and how he found, after being in the jungle for a year or so, that this wasn't at all true. They had difficulties with their food, and when they were ill, they had no medicines at all.
And so he gave himself up.
He came in about 4 months ago, yes.
Kuang is a typical resettlement area, part of a very large-scale attempt to keep food and information from the bandits, which the Harold Briggs, who was director of operations in 1950, started. About 500,000 Chinese, that's a fifth of the total Chinese population of Malaya, were squatters in outlying parts of the country, farming clearings in the jungle and so on. The Briggs plan was to collect these squatters in resettlement areas, if possible, near rubber estates or other sources of employment, surround the areas with wire fences, give the people police protection, and save them from being a prey to the bandits, and of course cut the bandits off at the same time from one of their main sources of food. Well, about 400,000 of these squatters have already been put into these resettlement areas, which has been a gigantic undertaking. The bandits, of course, make out that these settlements are sort of concentration camps, and that's absolute nonsense, because I've seen plenty of them. But I have also seen that the protection that the people in them get is in most cases hopelessly inadequate. An ordinary single barbed wire fence isn't going to stop a bandit with a pair of wire cutters walking in and demanding a bag of rice, with throat slitting as an alternative. Meanwhile, until the whole population can be protected and the bandits be squeezed out by being cut off from all sources of supplies, the rubber estates and tin mines must be fully guarded. I began off by introducing you to Mrs. Lucy on the Amherst rubber estate, because rubber is by far and away the most important economic factor in Malaya. It was late one afternoon when I drove out to meet the Lucys. They live only about 8 miles from Kuala Lumpur, but it's by no means a healthy neighborhood. We drove through a big Chinese village, and then through a succession of little Malay kampongs, little villages, or sometimes only a cluster of lightly built palm-thatched huts with sometimes one fairly substantial house. And then on into wild country, where a river ran alongside the road and the jungle came down to it on both sides. It was a curious sensation to feel that the bandits might be very close for all one knew, because it was impossible to see through the dense jungle for more than 25 yards or so, and sometimes less. We turned up a narrow, sandy road and satisfied a succession of Malay guards that we were all right, and finally arrived at the bungalow. When it got dark, we went indoors. The Lucys have a little circular bar in their living room, and up above it were hanging three hats. One was a topi with a great piece out of the front as if it had been bitten out. Beside it was a homemade military cap with a tin star, and the third was also a homemade military cap with a star roughly embroidered in red on it. While I was looking at him, Mr. Lucy came in. I asked him about these trophies.
I was inspecting an estate, and coming back I was passing another of my estates, and I thought I'd just stop the car and have a look into one of the fields. And I got out of the car and I carried my shotgun with me, rather automatically, because I wasn't expecting any danger. I happened to have left my bag of cartridges in the car, so I was walking about with just a shotgun, which was loaded, and one special constable who accompanied me. I was walking up the terraces, looking at the rubber, and suddenly through the corner of my eye, I saw a terrorist lying out in a lion-led position with his rifle pointing at me. Luckily, I'm used to a shotgun, and I quickly pulled down my shotgun and shot him, and luckily got him in the head. At the same moment, my special constable on a terrace above me saw another terrorist with a Sten gun pointing at him. He too fired first and got him in the head. I then retreated onto the road and called up my armored car. I looked up to see my special constable still standing up in the midst of heavy fire from the rest of the gang of terrorists. I had to call him back. He came back into the car. When he got back, he asked me never to call him back again, because he was not frightened, and he was quite sure he could have got another one.
That was a Malay special constable.
That was a Malay special constable, a very excellent fellow. He's now my personal guard.
We went and changed and then sat down to dinner. We were just about finishing when there was the sound of a car. It stopped outside, and a police lieutenant, Lieutenant Wright, came in on his rounds. He sat down and said that things were reasonably quiet that night. I asked him, well, Lieutenant, you go on patrols most nights here, don't you?
Yes, nights and early mornings. Mainly maintaining the SC posts on the various estates and tin mines.
Now, you looked in here this evening, for instance. This is just part of a patrol, was it?
Oh, yes, this is a normal SC post, and this is one more place that we keep up to scratch with the SCs doing their job and maintaining a proper watch against bandits.
What do you go around in?
Well, an open Land Rover, actually.
It can't be very healthy at nights in particular, is it?
With lots of fresh air, but I'm wondering what I'll get next.
Yes, indeed. Well, can't they armour these things?
I think there is a move afoot to do this. I'm not sure when, but I believe that there are people trying to do this for the Land Rovers to get armour plating for them.
Well, Lieutenant Wright had to continue on his patrol, but before he left, he got in contact with police headquarters on his radio.
Hello, Control, Love 4 to Control. Receiving you Strength 5, Love 4 to Control, over.
Love 4 from Control. For your information, report hearing shots in direction of 5th or 6th mile. Gamansara Road.
Hello, Control. Love 4 to Control. Roger so far. Have you anything further, over?
Love 4 from Control. Just one thing. This firing was investigated by Police Lieutenant IC Police Division Figures 20, Kia Rural District, and could not be traced anywhere in that district. That is all the action we've ever taken, over.
Lockwood Control, thank you for the information. Roger out.
And with that, Lieutenant Wright went off again on his patrol. No country in the world has such a large police force in proportion to the size of its population as Malaya, and it certainly needs it. It's of the utmost importance to all of us that the rubber estates and the tin mines are protected so that they can keep going. You know, Malaya may seem to be very remote to most people in this country, but with rubber and tin, she produced 51%, more than half of the dollar earnings in the British Commonwealth. Mr. H.H. Facer, one of the most important figures in the rubber industry, put this to me in much more simple language when, in his office in Kuala Lumpur, I asked him about Malayan dollar earnings.
During the years 1942 to 1945, disaster, not the first one by any means, descended on the rubber industry. Some estates were maintained during the occupation, but the majority were in an appalling state. The jungle had come back, and planters returning faced the prospect of literally digging their estates out again. Labor was scattered. Many Indian laborers had been taken to Siam to work on the railway, and those who were left were in very poor shape physically. It was a situation calculated to discourage the most dauntless. But it was tackled, and tackled so successfully, that in 1949, an all-time record crop was harvested. What this has meant to the British Commonwealth and nations, in the form of dollar exchange, has been said too often to need repeating. But I do remember a member of the House of Commons who came out here some 3.5 to 4 years ago, putting it in this way. He said it might be taken for granted that if it were not for rubber, the people of England could make up their minds to stop eating on Friday and start again on the following Tuesday. That is perhaps an exaggeration, but there can be no doubt that bad as the financial situation is today, it would be infinitely worse if it were not for rubber. And now, last but not least of the disasters which have descended upon the industry, is the present menace of communist terror. Managers, their assistants, Asian staffs, and even the laborers themselves are still producing rubber, but they are doing it at the risk of their lives.
It's the same in a lesser degree with tin. The emergency was certainly brought home to me when I was making arrangements to go and see a Tindridge. I've been discussing this with the director of the company. Well, I'll telephone the manager and fix the time, I said as I was leaving. For heaven's sake, don't do anything of the kind, the director said. You've no idea who may be listening in, and that's just the way to run yourself into an ambush. Yes, the emergency is having its effect on the tin mining industry, just as it is on rubber. Mr. Douglas Waring, a director of the biggest group of companies in Malaya, gives a good idea of this.
Of those engaged in tin mining, 123 individuals of various nationalities have been murdered, others wounded or abducted, and over 240 attacks have been made on mining installations and plants. That production has been maintained reflects the courage and steadfastness of the mining staff, but it is useless to deny that it has had no effect on the standard of output. Mining personalities of all nationalities have to work under the protection of armed guards. They sleep in mining camps surrounded by barbed wire and searchlights, and they travel, when they have to, in armor-protected vehicles. Social activities, the visiting of friends in the evenings, and the occasional weekend trip to the local town, forms of relaxation which are normally part of the life of those who are required to live and work in lonely places, and memories of the past. And for over 3 years now, mining staff had to stay put in their own locality, except when on leave. I need hardly add that these abnormal conditions are putting an undue strain on everybody working in the mining industry. And for that reason alone, we are very much concerned that the situation should be cleared up as soon as possible. But what is perhaps even more serious from a long-term point of view is that the vital prospecting work to find new areas to replace those now being mined out is at a complete standstill owing to lack of security.
Well, this is a somewhat sketchy personal report of some of the things I saw and some of the people I met. But I hope it gives you an idea of the conditions that British planters and miners, soldiers and police and all those who are working with them are living under. And that I've brought home to you the tremendous importance to us all of the job they're doing. Indirectly, they're providing us with half our food. And at the same time, they're fighting communism in one of the danger spots of the world.